in talk radio and liberals are not. I would suggest to you that the opportunity is there for us, and Head On Radio Network is the way to address it. We're at the end of our program. I hear that music, so we're going to call it for a day. This is Bill O'Brien on the Head On Radio Network. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back again. I'll be back with you at the end of the week. Please have a wonderful week, and by all means, be safe. We need you. This is Bill O'Brien. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to The Horn, the Head On Radio Network.
This is the Quality News Network. President Bush is on a visit to the Southwest to lobby for a new guest worker program for illegal immigrants. The president is calling for an immigration pact with Congress no later than August. Tens of thousands of Shia marched through two holy cities in Iraq today in commemoration of the fall of Saddam Hussein. Protesters in Najaf called U.S. forces and its allies, quote, occupiers, demanding that they leave Iraq. Tightened security in Baghdad includes a 24-hour ban on all vehicles inside the capital city, due to be lifted by tomorrow morning. The Pentagon announced 10 U.S. soldiers were killed over the weekend, six of them on Sunday. Sectarian violence in the past 2 days killed 65 Iraqis and wounded another 29. British military officials placed a ban on all future military interviews with the media for payment. The decision effectively puts an end to the possibility that the 15 British Marines and sailors held hostage by Iran could sell their stories. Iran announced today it is increasing production of enriched uranium. The UN Security Council has demanded Tehran abandon such enrichment, which can be used for either nuclear power or a nuclear weapons program. In Seoul, an American delegation today was told UN inspectors would be permitted to visit North Korea's nuclear facilities as soon as the U.S. returns $25 million in North Korean funds frozen in a Macau bank. A February agreement calls on Pyongyang to shut down its main reactor by Saturday. In the Gaza, an Israeli airstrike killed one suspected militant and wounded two more. In East Timor today, residents are voting for president for the first time since they won independence from Indonesia that was 5 years ago. Eight candidates are on the ballot. The U.S. Senate focuses this week on stem cell legislation, considering two bills on the issue. President Bush vetoed a stem cell measure that was last year. Cartoonist Johnny Hart, who created the BC comic series, has passed away of a stroke in his New York home. He was 76 years old. One of the U.S. attorneys fired by the Bush administration has filed a complaint with an independent government agency. You're listening to the Quality News Network. We'll have a look at science and business news just ahead.
Monterey is the home of a new national radio voice. It's America Back on Track from the Quality News Network. Tune in weekdays at noon Pacific to this new national broadcast, a conversation with America designed to get our country back on track. America Back on Track features local and long-distance guests sharing global ideas on where we are, how we got here, where we want to go, and how we might get there. So take an hour out of your day to plug into the future, our future. Discover the solutions to the problems that have gridlocked our nation for all too long. Eschew the agenda-driven palaver of the left and the right. Tune into America Back on Track for honest talk about the important issues and how they can be resolved. America Back on Track, weekdays at noon on KRML, 1410 a.m. in the Monterey area, and streaming live online at QNNAmerica.com. America Back on Track, our ticket to a healthy and productive future.
Last week's deadly earthquake in the Solomon Islands raised one of the islands 10 feet up from the sea, destroying some of the most pristine coral reefs in the world. The exposed reefs are now dying, marine life rotting in the air. The area most affected has yet to be reached by relief workers. A Dutch study says people who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder appear to be less sensitive to physical pain. The researchers say their findings indicate post-traumatic patients' brains may be wired differently. CIT Group Incorporated placed three of its top executives with its student loan program on paid leave. That was in connection with an investigation into stock transactions between a federal Department of Education official and college financial aid officers. A consortium of U.S. buyout firms and Middle Eastern investors are expected to submit a $50 billion offer to acquire Dow Chemical. Analysts say it would be the world's largest leverage buyout in corporate history. Job growth rose more than expected in March, according to the Labor Department. 180,000 non-farm jobs were added to the nation's payrolls. Unemployment dropped to 4.4%. That's a five-month low. Light sweet crude trading at $61.55 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. That's down $2.73. The Dow down, make that up 8 points for the Dow, 12,568. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
Good afternoon, Horn listeners. On this afternoon's Radio Inside Scoop with Mark Levine, we present Uncivil Discourse, Politics Gone Wild. While Mark attends this year's conference on world affairs in Colorado, the Radio Inside Scoop will present panels from the 2006 conference that Mark recorded while he was there last year. What we're going to do is I'm going to play as much of this as will fit into this hour, and we'll just continue with it tomorrow. So thank you, folks, and enjoy the show.
Those of you who don't have your programs, this is panel number 2202, Uncivil Discourse, Politics Gone Wild. I'm Sam Fuqua from KGNU, the mostly civil world of non-commercial community radio. Thank you all for coming this morning. We're going till about 11:50. Let me briefly introduce our four panelists. To my immediate right, Simon Hoggart, a longtime and frequent visitor to the conference. He writes a daily humorous political column for The Guardian of London, writes about wine and television for The Spectator of London, and until March of this year chaired the popular BBC network radio show The News Quiz. David Bernkoff is to Simon's right, a principal at Altamira Communications in Atlanta, a media strategy company that focuses on public policy issues. Prior to founding Altamira 4 years ago, Bernkoff spent over 20 years at CNN in Atlanta. James Turner is next on the panel, a partner in the law firm of Swanken & Turner in Washington, D.C., also president of the National Institute for Science, Law, and Public Policy, a nonprofit organization founded to bridge the gap between scientific uncertainties and the need for laws and protecting public health and safety. And then down at the other end of the table, Mark Levine, a syndicated talk show host. The Inside Scoop is his radio, television, and internet talk show. Prior to his radio debut in 2003, he served for 3 years as legislative counsel to Congressman Barney Frank. Those are brief bios of all our panelists, so you can read more about them in your conference program. But we'll get right to the topic of uncivil discourse. David Bernkoff will speak first.
I come here very worried about the anger and nastiness and vitriol and dishonesty, and that's just the way the panelists feel about each other. So.
See, it worked.
Good line.
But seriously, folks, I was just reading a story that did worry me, and it's about our president. Rumors of his homosexuality and the tale of how an old friend of his and he shared a bed together for many years prior to becoming president. And I'm talking, of course, of President Lincoln. And I only tell that story to point out that every time we worry about the uncivil discourse of our politics, we need only look back at our history and see that there are many times when things have been as bad or worse. But that doesn't mean things are particularly good right now and that we're all getting along just fine. There's a story of an ABC producer a couple of weeks ago in Washington who was suspended because he sent an email to someone on his staff during a presidential speech, and it said, "This guy is making me crazy. He's same old stuff." Well, that got out. Somebody who wanted to make a point at ABC, leaked that to somebody else, and it got in the blogosphere, and ABC had to suspend that producer for an unstated amount of time. And I thought back to my days at CNN, if every time I'd sent an email or a text message like that about anybody, Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, I'd have been suspended about every third day, because it's the nature of being a news person is you get angry at hearing the same speech over and over again. But yet something has changed in our discourse to the point where in some cases we can't even have those private, honest conversations anymore without somebody taking a line out of it and making a broader political point, and then other people having to respond to that. And all of a sudden, a guy who maybe did say something he shouldn't have said is out of a job for a while. Now, the nature of the sort of angry discourse that we see and we hear on talk radio and on cable television and in newspapers, I'm not so sure whether I really am depressed about it or not, because I don't know the answer to the question of whether this kind of political discussion gets people revved up, excited, makes them want to vote, makes them want to get involved on both sides, or does it depress them, anger them, turn them off to the whole process and make them not want to vote, or is it some combination of both of those, which is what I think it is. So I'm not totally a hand-wringer here about the nature of angry political discourse being a negative, but I do think we are at one of those points in our history where it's as bad as it gets. I don't know that it's the worst ever, but it's pretty bad right now. People don't seem to want to talk to each other. I find myself personally, as someone who covered politics for many years at CNN and someone who loves to talk politics, I avoid talking politics to my neighbors now because I'm afraid of getting into an angry conversation that I don't wish to get involved with anymore. And I don't think that's healthy for me. So hopefully you all will have a conversation with us today that keeps away from the nasty side, and we all learn something from each other.
Thanks, David Bernkopf. How about Mark Levine down there?
Well, here's the problem with negative campaigning. It works. If it didn't work, people wouldn't do it. I was thinking of a different historical example than Abraham Lincoln. In Grover Cleveland's election, it was rumored, probably correctly, that he'd had a child out of wedlock, and the opposing campaign was, Ma, Ma, where's my pa? Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha. I'm not making that up. Be too weird to make up. There was a time, actually, when Republicans and Democrats actually kind of got along. I think back to Ronald Reagan's years, where Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House, and those two Irishmen would go, I don't mean anything by this stereotypically, but they would go have drinks together, and Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill couldn't agree on hardly anything. But there was a time back in the 80s when members of Congress would get along personally. That doesn't happen now. As someone who worked in Congress for a number of years, I can tell you they don't go out for drinks anymore, hardly ever. They don't socialize anymore. They don't talk to each other anymore. And a lot of this, I think, can be dated back to the Newt Gingrich, some call the revolution of 1994, where it was determined, paint the Democrats as demons, and when the L word, liberal, became somehow un-American, I'm not sure when that was, but I think it was sometime in the early 90s, and there was a coordinated effort to make your political enemy your American enemy. I see it very common with this president when he says, in effect, that there are fair and unfair discourse. And he's not talking about someone insulting him. He's not talking about someone being uncivil. But he gave a recent speech today where he said that if you suggest that there was data manipulated to get us to war in Iraq, that's off the bounds. That's out of bounds. That's out of political discussion. That's uncivil. And I think we have to distinguish here between civility, if you will, and craven compromise. All right? The right often talks about the angry left. And by saying that, they mean to delegitimize any complaint that our president doesn't happen to follow this document, the Constitution of the United States, which I have made repeatedly on my radio show. And they say that if you're angry, you by definition are wrong. I'm very angry at this president. I don't mind admitting it. I'm actually more angry at the people who control him, Karl Rove and Dick Cheney, than this guy who, you know, claims to be president. But I am angry. I admit it. And I'm angry because I happen to believe in democracy, and I happen to believe in the Constitution of the United States, and I don't like to see a president of the United States who, you know, wants to eavesdrop in violation of the Fourth Amendment, wants to pick people, American citizens, up on the street and not give them a trial in violation of the Sixth Amendment. I mean, it goes on and on and on. This is a president who has violated his oath of office and I think should be impeached. Now, I can say that civilly. I didn't raise my voice. Yes, I think this president's violated the Constitution and should be impeached. I do. Is that angry? Is that uncivil? Well, you know, some would argue that saying that adultery is an impeachable act, that was uncivil to Bill Clinton. Some would say that saying that Bill Clinton murdered Vince Foster is uncivil. Some would say that Rush Limbaugh calling feminists feminazis is a bit uncivil. And so, you know, incivility is something it's happened a long time. I actually pride myself on the fact that on my radio show, I invite people I agree with, I invite people I disagree with. I regularly invite people I disagree with, and I generally have very civil conversations, except when, people try to drown me out, in which case I have to raise my voice, and then it gets ugly. But the problem is this. If you take a poll, and there was a very interesting poll taken in the 2004 election, very few people remember, this audience probably does, but very few people remember that John Kerry, at his acceptance speech, said, in effect, let's do this on the high road. Let's not go down the low road. Let's not insult each other. Let's not do unfair negative campaigning. And George Bush, of course, rejected that. He said, you know, Bush, let's do it. Bush, of course, said, no, I won't, and went on to Swift Boat Liars and other things. But when that happened, when you had, in effect, a man, you know, bedecked with medals, and they were challenging his patriotism, John Kerry, and you had this nasty, slanderous, Swift Boat Liars campaign, and you had Kerry really not do the same thing to Bush. I mean, Bush, here's a guy who was high on cocaine, right, who didn't show up for the National Guard. And by the way, I have the orders on my website that show the direct orders. He's supposed to be in Alabama on a specific date. He wasn't there. So he violated a direct military order. And Kerry said, you know what, that's negative campaigning. We're not going to go there. But here's the interesting thing. Bush allies did massive negative campaigning. Kerry did virtually no negative campaigning. And what happened, if you poll the public, they said both sides are too negative. There's no question. It was like 45% of the Republicans were too negative and 39% of the Democrats were too negative. It was slightly more for the Republicans. The problem is, if you run a positive campaign and they run a negative campaign, it's like going into a boxing ring and you hit above the belt and they hit below the belt. And when that happens, you lose. So I'm all for civility if both sides do it. But when the other side stops being civil, unfortunately, it's like fighting with your pants down. And what we found is that the other side has been uncivil for a long time. I look in the talk radio world, I look at a performance artist, and that's what I consider her, like Ann Coulter. Now, this is a woman who cannot believe the stuff that spouts out of her mouth. She's a performance artist. She understands that if she says extreme, radical, awful, uncivil things, like, let's kill all the Muslims and convert them to Christianity, if she says that, then she's going to get some press. And those of us that are reasonable are not. And that's how it works. That's how Rush Limbaugh became famous. That's what they tell us in the radio world, right? It doesn't matter what the issues are. Just say something extreme. And so you get the Michael Savages of the world and so forth. The sad thing is, as much as we all claim to want civility, the uncivil get a lot of attention. Too much attention. And if it didn't work, people wouldn't do it. And so I would argue, stick to your guns. Understand what is civil and uncivil. It is not uncivil to say the president violated the Constitution and should be impeached. That's a legal question. We can argue it. It is uncivil to call him a Nazi. There are differences. Stick to your guns. Don't let them tell you that saying your political views is somehow uncivil, even if it's something as extreme as impeachment. But at the same time, I think if you keep an even keel, an even voice, we can distinguish between justified anger and speech that really is beyond the pale. Thank you.
Mark Levine. Turn to Simon Hoggart next.
Thanks. Like David, I want to complain about the anger, the nastiness, the vitriol, and the sheer dishonesty. There isn't enough of it. At least there isn't a home. And in England, it's not. I'd like to tell you that it's a wonderful, innocent political world in which people treat each other with the kind of courtesy you'd expect in an old Oscar Wilde play. As they sip tea and eat cucumber sandwiches. It's not, but it's not, in my view, unpleasant enough. We could only look on in aghast amazement at the Veterans for Truth campaign against Kerry. I mean, the extraordinary way in which people were somehow enabled to vote against the hero and the patriot in order to vote for a draft-dodging slime ball like... Oh, I know, to go for the cheap laughs, anyway. We do occasionally have it. My main job is writing what we call the parliamentary sketch, which is a daily account of events in Parliament, which I try to make fairly humorous, not always successfully, and that's kind of fun. One of my predecessors was a rather morose man who nevertheless wrote beautifully. He was a very, very shy man, and he was a wonderful writer, but of course most journalism involves talking to people, and he hated doing that. So they tried him out as a theatre critic, because he wouldn't need to talk to anyone, and movie critic didn't really work, and then they sent him to do my job, which involved just watching politicians for most of the day, and then writing an article. And he wrote beautiful prose, and it was very gentle. He was never cruel, never harsh. He'd always write some, might say, Principal Thatcher was in a bad temper, the school had been misbehaving, or something like that. A nice, elongated metaphor. And he was loved. The politicians thought he was just wonderful, and they would ask to meet him. And I would ask him if he would like to meet the politicians, and he would say, "No, dear boy, I never, ever meet them." Well, why not? They love you. They're your greatest fans. "If I did, it might spoil the purity of my hatred for them." Well, one thing that came out, there was an MP, a member of Parliament I particularly liked because he's a very funny guy. Three journalists, including me and I, shared a taxi from the House of Commons to the Irish Embassy, where we were bidden to the annual Christmas party, which, as you might imagine, is one of the highlights of our social scene anyway. We got in, and the taxi driver turned round to us and said, "Here, you lot MPs then?" And Peter Snape, the MP, the only politician among us, said, "Oh no, we're not MPs, we hate the bastards, don't we? We loathe them, I can't stand them, they're all fucking corrupt, aren't they? All the crooks, they're all in for what they can get. Labour, Conservative, they're all the bloody same. You can't put a thing between them, I can't stand them. Frankly, I'll string the lot of them up. In fact, hanging's too good for them, in my view." And he managed to keep this up all the way to the Irish Embassy. And when we got out and paid, the cab driver looked at him with awed admiration and said, "I've never heard it put better." We do have the occasional remark, good remark is made. Thatcher, who was both loved and hated, attracted more nicknames than any other British politician I know. There was... Tina, because of her much-quoted phrase, "There is no alternative," to throwing 3 million people out of work, or whatever it was. The Iron Lady, which was wished upon her by a Soviet military magazine, which was meant as an insult, but she wore as a badge of honour, and would say, "As you can see, the Iron Lady is wearing softly flowing taffeta tonight." A character in an old thriller called She by Rider Haggard, about a strange African tribe ruled by a female goddess known as She Who Must Be Obeyed. Well, that fitted very, very perfectly with Mrs. Thatcher. But the one that really stuck and I always liked best was Attila the Hen. Yeah. Churchill was a master of invective. Was a very, very, well, the only word is, I know we're supposed to say, a circumferentially challenged person, a very fat woman, an MP called Bessie Braddock, who stood up in the middle of a speech that Churchill was making in the House of Commons and said, "You're drunk." And Churchill replied, "Yes, I am. And you are ugly. But I shall be sober in the morning." He particularly disliked, he kind of admired, but was very resentful of Clement Attlee, who had been his deputy prime minister through the war, who was leader of the Labour Party, and who won, to Churchill's absolute rage and astonishment, the election in 1945 by a huge majority. And Churchill was astonished by this. He felt that Attlee had no personality at all, and he did. He was that wonderful line that, remember when somebody said that Walter Mondale had no charisma, and his wife said, "Yes, he does. He has Norwegian charisma." And I think it was Jim Lehrer. No, it can't have been Jim Lehrer. Somebody wittier than that. Mark Shields maybe said, "Yeah, well, if you think about it, so does a sardine." Attlee had very little charisma, and Churchill delighted in being offensive about him. A modest man with much to be modest about. And an empty taxi drew up at the House of Commons, and Mr. Attlee got out. But you're a... of another Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, it was said, "How can you tell he's lying? Because his lips are moving." Tony Blair is also much hated these days, not by everybody, but by a hefty proportion of people. I think one of the things that we find alarming is that there's nothing you can say to Blair that that seems to throw his equanimity at all. A comedian I quoted yesterday who said, "You know, isn't it weird, that glassy smile Blair has all the time? If you went up to him and you said, 'Your son is a crackhead and your wife is a whore,' he'd say, 'Well, that's two points of view.'" I loved some of the great lines here, of course. You know, the first George Bush Sr. looked like every woman's first husband. And that you should be familiar. I love the one, too, about him, that he looks like the kind of guy who'd get out of the shower to take a leak. You know that J.K. Galbraith used to be U.S. ambassador to India, from where he sent incredibly long cables to the White House, direct to JFK, detailing every single thing that had happened in India that day. The great file of these appeared, a massive pile of them, all completely unread by the president. And an aide said to him, "Mr. President, what should we do with these cables from Galbraith?" And Kennedy said, "Galbraith, Galbraith, if you gave him an enema, you could get his remains in a matchbox." Just very briefly, I think Mark's point about negative campaigning kind of works. It's got to have a resonance. I mean, we tried it in Britain. I don't have to bore you with details of British politics, because who cares? Most of us don't in Britain, so why should you? But it's interesting, the Conservatives, who knew they were about to lose, in 1997, they'd had 18 years of government, mainly Mrs. Thatcher, then the wonderfully, woefully incompetent John Major. I once wrote it was watching him trying to govern the country was like watching Edward Scissorhands try to make balloon animals. And they, it's always rather sad that I never caught on. So they decided as a last throw they would go for very negative campaigning, and they had a huge posters depicting Tony Blair with satanic red eyes. That was all, just as if he, you know, like a scene from The Omen or something, or The Exorcist. And it didn't work because nobody believed that he was a satanic person. I mean, they've learned different now, of course, but in those days he just seemed, as he put it himself, a pretty straight kind of guy. It didn't work. Blair won by a landslide. Another one they had was picture of him as a ventriloquist's doll on the knee of Chancellor Kohl of Germany to imply that he would be ordered around by bigger powers in the European Union. That didn't work because nobody thought he would be. It just failed, and he won by another landslide. On the other hand, the Labour Party depicted the then Conservative leader, William Hague, with a wig, a Thatcher wig on, just a picture of the guy with this one wig, and it said, who are you voting for? And the line was, she chose him, you'll get her back. She will return to haunt you. And that was very successful, and they won a third landslide. It was a dollar saying, actually. So, saying it hasn't really caught on. I think we're kind of lucky, too, in that you can't buy paid TV. You get a certain amount of TV at election time, but very, very little. So there's no... The equivalent of Madison Avenue has no call to do their worst because there simply is almost no market for it. And I guess we're kind of lucky in that way, but I really do miss the rough and tumble, the sheer... I must finish, but you know, if you're in a small market, like say, I remember being in North Dakota once during an election year, midterm elections, and watching TV there was like being at a very, very bad dinner party in which the guests are having a fight and won't stop, because everyone can afford, since you can buy TV time 30 seconds in North Dakota for $1.50. Say, Senator Toad Thrush believes that our children should have pornography available at all times. They should have them in their school lunchboxes. This is because Clause 897 of some bill would not have banned Playboy from appearing on the bookshelf. So then it's a candidate, my Democrat opponent, says that all seniors should be left out in the snow to starve. Because they are a drain on our precious resources. That's an equally obscure misquoted line. But they don't just do it once, they do it over and over again. So you kind of watch Friends or the news or something, and you just watch this wretched, ghastly argument. And I love it. I really enjoy it, and I kind of wish we had it at home. Thank you very much.
Simon Hoggart. And now James Turner.
On the way over, I met him in the hall and gave him my speech. The chaplain of the House in 1860 called on a prayer. He said, for the House assembled, dear God, more brains, more brains. The kind of politics that we have probably has been going on pretty much in this country from the beginning. One of the big things that politicians did in the early days was to get their own newspaper. So Jefferson had his newspaper and Andrew Jackson had his newspaper, and they would sit around all these different newspapers and fight with each other in some of the most scudsy kind of things you could ever imagine. Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings was front page news for a while. Alexander Hamilton's relationship with one of his subordinate's wife was equally news. They did this kind of thing continuously. And so I suspect it's probably not all that much worse now, other than the fact that it gets broadcast in a much louder megaphone. But if you listen carefully, you can notice how things shift, even inside this uncivil kind of communications. I saw David Brooks, who's the New York Times conservative reporter, on the Lehr Report, well, maybe 6 months ago, and I knew things were beginning to turn because he said, he's a conservative, backs Bush on just about everything. And he said, well, the question on Bush is out for the moment. Either he will be one of the great presidents or the worst president we've ever had. Now, this is a supporter saying this. And from that day on, things got worse and worse for Bush. One thing I heard that what struck me interestingly the other day is a person who was not too upset about Bush being elected because and he was telling me, you know, you can really be wrong in this town. Old hand in Washington, and he said, you know, when Bush was elected, I really felt nervous, but I said, well, at least he's got adults around him. And he says, that shows what I know. It is a tough situation. I'm not sure that the incivility of bad campaigning and loud voices is the real problem. I think that the equanimity with which lying goes on is just shocking. That I find amazing. And it's not only that the lying goes on, but a lot of people are afraid to call the liars. They just say things and... it may be that the worst side effect of all of this is that a lot of people are pretty cowed, particularly if they work for the government. If you have friends, I live in Washington, D.C., and if you have friends that work in the government, there's a sort of a common conversation that goes on. First of all, whatever's going on in their agency, they're not happy about. The entire government has been laid over with two or three levels of political appointees. The people who work in these jobs, I mean, let's put it this way. FEMA was fairly efficient compared to many of the other agencies. I mean, I'm not kidding. I mean, they're in very bad shape. Systematically, all activity that's done by the agencies seems to be being turned into political campaigning. I just noticed that yesterday, I guess, Bush acknowledged having declassified the intelligence report that is the center of the Valerie Plame case. And his position is that he needed to, you know, sort of make things clear that there really was evidence of weapons of mass destruction. But the document that he allegedly declassified, which was only partially released and then inaccurately, that document says the opposite. But as yet, there's nobody around who is actually seriously taking it on as a fundamental debate. There is a nascent impeach Bush movement, and it gets laughed at. And John Conyers, who has been sort of a key person in pushing that effort, said, I really, you know, I hope it goes somewhere, but whether it goes somewhere or not is not the real issue. The issue is I need to stand up, and I need to be able to say in the future I stood up when the time came to stand up. Unfortunately, he is only one small guy in a big house of people. The issue that I think that we're facing is the incivility of the campaigning and so forth is what it is, and I think it's been around pretty much all along. But what we do have is a real serious effort to drive people away from the political process. I note that the polls have Bush down, solid supporters for Bush, 20%. That's roughly what he got of the electorate in the election. If you think about it, he got about 50% of about 50%. So that his, because 50% of the people voted and about half of them voted for him. It is not truly a representative democracy when you have an individual who is the leader who has roughly between 20 and 25% of the population voting for him. That is a serious problem. When you look at the way that the House is elected, take Pennsylvania. More Democrats voted for House members by a substantial amount, but by two-thirds, Republicans were elected because of the way the state's gerrymandered. The process that we live with is supposed to be a process that finds out, you know, kind of by electoral activities and so forth, what the country believes in, and then sort of translates it into policy, and it sort of comes out somewhere. But that is not how it works. Probably never worked that way. But it's very dangerous in a situation when you have the kinds of decisions that are having to be made every day, when the professionals are being cleaned out of being able to actually influence those decisions, and every single decision, every single announcement is a campaign announcement. Perpetual campaigning. I'm not sure exactly what to do about it, except I wish that the people who were the opponents would be a little bit more upfront about attacking some of the things that are going on. My understanding is, just as he said, that you got to be very, very careful in the way that the media is portraying all of the activities that go on politically, because the whole mass of politics is looked at as one thing, Everybody in it is looked at as the same. Everybody who is attacked looks the same. It's very difficult to differentiate. And in that kind of a setting, we have a situation where what we think of as the government is actually it's actually an in-place political party. It's not actually out there governing. And I suspect, I mean, I know what's going on with some of the science research at the university here. It's a very serious issue that you need to deal with, think about, and it's way beyond whether the campaigning is civil or not civil. It's actually way beyond. I can remember when the turn of the century occurred, and I have been pretty clear in my own reading and so forth that I thought this was going to be the century of China. And I asked myself, how long will it be before America loses its senior standing in the world, and what will be the mechanism? What are the historical forces that are going to happen? How long will they take to work out? I didn't think it was going to be a small group of people from Texas and it would take 5 years. I mean, we're pretty far behind the eight ball in a lot of ways at this point. And it's more than the incivility of campaigning. It's just a general way of having, I'm not even sure it's a competing views of what the country is. It's like there is what the country is and then there's what's going on. What's most interesting about America is that over and over again it has faced crises of the, I think we're in a crisis, but over and over again we've faced crises like this, and somehow the people have pulled it out. So now I'm asking myself, what's going to be the mechanism for getting out of this mess? I mean, it's a mess on every front. And you sit here and look at the major corporations going bankrupt. You look at the people who are supposedly have insurance, losing their insurance. You look at the amount of dollars that the Chinese are holding. Anytime they want to pull the plug, they can, essentially. And you look at the standing of the opinion of the United States and of the world. You look at the healthcare system being, three times larger in cost than the next one and 35th on the list of healthcare systems in the world. You look at every decade of people's life expectancy and you find that the United States is running at somewhere between 50th and 60th in the world of people living in that age group. I mean, we're in a very, very bad spot with a group of people that don't seem to think that it's all that important. And I haven't even mentioned global warming. So, but I just say, the incivility that's on the surface and so forth, maybe an inconvenience, maybe it's a problem, but the fact that we have so little influence on what it is that the government does is a serious problem that we need to do something about and think about.
James Turner. I thank all our panelists for their comments, and before we open it up to the audience, some time for the panelists to go back and forth with one another, react to anything anybody else said. I was interested, James Turner, in your comment about uncivil politics, nasty politics, driving people away. Does it serve the interest of both parties to keep it nasty, because then they just focus on their base and everybody else is turned off?
Well, I suspect that that's a lot of it. I also, the other problem, of course, is you can say that in 2000 that the negative campaigning of the Republicans worked, but in fact Gore didn't get the most votes. I mean, it's so that there are a lot of other ways that things that power transfers, just not only by keeping people away from voting. Mm-hmm. There are other things that happen that make trouble. The system that we have for selecting how we make decisions is not reflecting what it is that the people of the country would like to see happen. And you may be right. They may be being forced out by conscious effort.
Yeah, I've had this sneaking suspicion for many decades now that is exactly what is the goal of both parties, because as voter turnout becomes a science, as you are more able to target the groups and individuals who are most likely to support you, if you think about it, a group of 10 people could vote. You know on your side how two of them are going to vote. The other side knows on their side how two of them are going to vote. And the six in the middle, well, that's kind of tough. We've got to work harder for them. You are better off as a political strategist to keep those six people from voting and then making sure that your two people get out and vote. The other side's doing the same thing, making sure their two people get out and vote. And you actually do things like negative campaigning, not because it works in the sense of getting more votes for your candidate, but it works in the sense of depressing the vote of the general public and firing up your base.
I think that sometimes civility, it goes down to the least common denominator. I have this problem on my show. Every Tuesday, I have Debate Tuesday. I invite someone on air with whom I disagree. It's a sort of a proud tradition. And sometimes I get people who disagree with me very civilly. They happen to be some of my favorite guests. And we disagree on everything, but we can laugh and we can joke and we can really get at it. Then every now and then I invite a guest on the air. For example, I invited a man by the name of David Horowitz. I don't know if you know who he is. But I invited him on my show because I wanted to show that, you know, I'm not afraid of anybody. I want to bring all comers. You know, I would love to debate Rush Limbaugh or any of the other people, you know, have them on the air. So he came on the air and went into this filibuster. He started talking 2-3 minutes where he called all Democrats communists and so forth. And I interrupted him uncivilly. And I said, now you said that all Democrats are communists. You happen to know a lot about communists since you are a former communist, admittedly. He went from left wing to right wing. And you happen to know that that's not true. Why did you say that? At which point he said, well, let me finish my other thing. And he goes on for another minute. I'm like, okay, you've gone on another minute. Now answer my question. Why did you call a Democrat communist? At which point he said, I never said that. At which point I said to him, in the commercial, we will run back the tape where you did say that, at which point he said, I don't have to take this anymore, and he hung up in the middle of the interview. That was uncivil. But sometimes in order to press the point, you have to be uncivil. And I'm an ex-trial lawyer, and you get used to the fact that you have a witness on the stand, and I think it was Robert McNamara who said, if you don't like the question you're asked, answer what you wish you were asked. Well, I have guests that do that all the time. I ask them a tough question, and they talk about what they want to talk about, and I say, well, I have. And there are people who, when I interrupt, would say, I'm being uncivil. And I would respond, well, I'm just trying to get them to answer the first question that I asked. So it's a problem. And I have people, I have to tell you, I get more complaints about Debate Tuesday than any other day of the week. It's also my highest ratings of any day of the week. So it's a weird dynamic there. There are definitely people that are turned off. And there are definitely people that are revved up. And there are people that tune into my show and say, you know what, I've heard enough of all this crossfire. I don't want to hear this, you know. And the problem is, if we all agreed on everything, it would be civil. But it wouldn't be interesting, and it wouldn't really relate to the issues of the day. So I find it a very fine line and a difficult line for me to walk. And I try to tell myself, I'll start out here. And if they meet me here, I'm fine. But if they descend, I have to go down to their level, otherwise I get shut out.
This is where I think we truly live in a parallel political universe now, and I'm going to take the not entirely natural position of trying to defend the right here, only because I think no one else will on this panel. you mentioned we have a president, and it's statistically accurate, who represents only 20%, 25% of the electorate right now. But that exact same argument was used to the anger and frustration of Democrats 10 years ago when they pointed out that Bill Clinton was a president with only 20%, you know, with only 45% of 50%. I mean, he had only 20% or 18% of the eligible voters vote for him. So he was even a more illegitimate president than George Bush. I mean, you can have these arguments endlessly, and they don't lead anywhere because we have the system we have. We have a system where 50% of people, or maybe 60 in a good year, or maybe 45 in a bad year, vote for president. We have a system where people can buy ads on TV. And so the people on the right have the same discussion with the same amount of anger towards the left that we all here in this room have towards, or many of us have towards the right. And there's the civil discourse disappears because nobody really wants to listen to the other.
I want to invite members of the audience, if you form a line at the aisle there, microphone, particularly interested in hearing from students. Do you have a question?
I have two questions, actually. Is that okay?
What's up with your mic?
Come closer to the
That's
mic.
Okay. We can hear you. We'll repeat it.
Shout it out.
Can I ask two questions?
Real quick.
Okay. First is to Mr. Levine. When you were talking about the negative campaigning with Bush versus Kerry, I was wondering if you were suggesting to fight fire with fire, and what will that produce?
Unfortunately, I think that's the only answer I know. We saw in the Kerry Bush election an attempt to fight fire with no fire. I mean, Kerry specifically said, I won't go negative, when you had people like Michael Moore and so forth point out truths, which was, you know, George Bush was AWOL, didn't show up for duty, hasn't said whether or not he did cocaine, but all his, you know, people that did it with him said that. And they tried to bring that out, and Kerry said, no, I'm not going to go there. I disavow that. At the same time as the Swift boat liars were going on, and Bush took weeks to very much say, well, you know, I don't really know. He didn't ever quite really disavow them. When you have someone fighting dirty, and you don't fight dirty, you lose. And I wish that weren't the case. But I'm afraid, yes, in the end, I am saying fight fire with fire. I would say hold your fire until they fire first. But when they fire, got to fire back.
Okay. And for all the moderators or whoever wants to answer it, I was wondering if any of you think there's ever been a time in any country where people don't get angry about politics, because I can't think of it.
It was the era of good feelings in 1824.
Yeah, <sir. laughs> Go ahead, sir. Sir?
I'm going to bring something in, if you'll pardon the expression, from left field. In the last day, we've had a lot of American flag demonstrations all over the United States, and in the last couple of weeks, similar ones. I think this may be throwing a big jar in a shift or a real hit into American politics. And how do you think this might affect political discourse? Because it's kind of unexpected from all these people who aren't part of the 20% of the 40% or whatever. I have a feeling there could be some differences. Do any of you think that's so, and do you think this will affect the discourse?
Were you talking about the immigration debate? Demonstrations over wearing your American flag, your Mexican flag?
Well, I think that's a great example of how people see what they want to see. Some of the initial reports, particularly on Fox News, were that the sea of protesters in Los Angeles at the biggest rally was a sea of Mexican flags. Then there were reports from others who wished to correct that, saying, no, most of the flags were American flags. And we're actually having this discussion, and I'm looking at the aerials that I saw, and I saw, you know, a mix of flags, and it didn't strike me particularly as bad one way or the other, but you know, when you can't even look at a group of people with flags and say, honestly, well, guess what? There were both Mexican and U.S. flags there. That's hard to have a serious debate when you're debating that.
On St. Patrick's Day, there are thousands of Americans that march with Irish and American flags, and I haven't heard any great Deport the Irish Americans Yet campaign.
No, but interestingly enough, Lou Dobbs did mention that he now opposes St. Patrick's Day celebrations for that exact reason.
I do think there is something about the immigration demonstrations that's important. You know, there are many things important, but in regard to the politics, I think that there are two things I want to say. First of all, I believe a great deal of what's politics in this country is going on outside the electoral process. There are many things that are happening with masses of people that are affecting the culture that are outside of what's going on in the elections and bills in Congress and so forth. The area that I work in primarily is in healthcare, and we have a huge rebellion against the healthcare system that we currently have, which is going on in ways that are not identified as electoral politics. And I believe that the immigration demonstrations are another example of political activity going on outside of the electoral political process. I think that's a good thing, by the way. I don't think that's a problem. I do want to say that there is an analysis of the politics going on in the country that's slightly different than the left-right spectrum, which I just think is worth your hearing, and you can look it up and think about it and see what you think. But the idea is that rather than a left-right spectrum, we actually have a matrix, which is a left-right axis and an order freedom axis. And that if you look at a number of issues, you will find order left and order right people actually debating with free right and free left people. That the split is in that manner. So you'll hear these strange things about so-called libertarians. And you'll find people who are supporting less government intervention into people's lives, made up, the constituencies doing that are made up of people who come from what you would think of as the left and the right. And people opposing them also come from the left and the right. And it's important to notice that, for example, in the Patriot debate, and you'll also, Patriot Act debate, and you'll also see it in certain aspects of the tax of the current budgetary debate. You'll find a kind of left-right coalition fighting another left-right coalition around issues. It's just important to recognize that the politics isn't as simple as there are conservatives and there are liberals and they fight with each other. And I also want to say that on the 20 to 25%, my point was not that Bush particularly, my point is that the presidency of the country is not actually representing the entire population. Part of the reason that I think there's politics going on outside of the electoral field is because...
This is the Quality News Network. During today's visit to the Southwest, President Bush pitched a new guest worker program for illegal immigrants. The president says he wants an immigration pact with Congress to be in place by late summer. British military officials placed a ban on all future military interviews with the media for payment. The decision effectively puts an end to the possibility that the 15 British Marines and sailors held hostage by Iran could sell their stories in the future. Iran announced it is increasing production of enriched uranium. The UN Security Council has demanded Tehran abandon such enrichment, which can be used for either nuclear power or a nuclear weapons program. In Seoul, an American delegation was told UN inspectors would be permitted to visit North Korea's nuclear facilities as soon as the U.S. returns $25 million in North Korean funds frozen in a Macau bank. A February agreement calls on Pyongyang to shut down its main reactor by Saturday. Tens of thousands of Shia marched through two holy cities in Iraq today in commemoration of the fall of Saddam Hussein. Protesters in Najaf called U.S. forces and its allies occupiers, demanding they leave Iraq. Tightened security in Baghdad, meantime, includes a 24-hour ban on all vehicles inside the capital city, due to be lifted by tomorrow morning. The Pentagon announced 10 U.S. soldiers were killed over the weekend, six of them on Sunday. Sectarian violence in the past 2 days killed 65 Iraqis and wounded another 29. In the Gaza, an Israeli airstrike killed one suspected militant and wounded two more. Also, a Palestinian militant was wounded in the West Bank. Israel has promised to retaliate against rockets routinely fired from that territory. In Greece, the captain and five crewmen from the cruise ship that sank near Santorini last week are now facing charges of negligence. 1,600 passengers and crew were evacuated.